The Lessons Learned for Vets podcast is proud to be brought to you by AFMA, the American Armed Forces Mutual Aid Association. Established in 1879, they are the longest standing nonprofit association empowering military families with affordable financial solutions for generations, offering life insurance, wealth management, mortgages, survivor assistance, and other benefits. AFMA is here to support you through every stage of life. AFMA is dedicated to helping service members be financially and logistically ready for life after the military. To support you in this process, AFMA would like to offer you their free downloadable transition timeline, a step-by-step guide to help you create a comprehensive military transition plan. Let AFMA help you get ready for your next step by visiting AFMA.com/LL4V, that's AAFMAA.com/LL4V, or clicking the link in the show notes. Welcome to the Lessons Learned for Vets podcast, your military transition debrief from the veteran mentors who've gone before you. My name is Lori Norris, and I've been teaching veterans how to successfully navigate their military transition since 2005. I'm a civilian who speaks the language of all branches of the U.S. military, and I'm on a mission to educate veterans in the job search marketing process. This podcast shares the military transition hot washes and after-action reports of your fellow veterans to smooth your own path out of the military.
I think I've always been humble. There hasn't been a situation or a job that I haven't found myself, you know, being required to have a sense of humility, just because there's no way that I can know everything about, you know, every aspect of my job. I don't have all the resources, all the knowledge. So I really rely on the people around me. And so that's one of the things that I recognized very early on, is that I can't do it by myself. And once I was able to give myself that freedom to say that it's not entirely your responsibility for your success, you know, wholly, that you're going to need mentorship, you're going to need guidance, but you're going to have to be open to all of those ideas. That's when I think the floodgates open. And I found myself being able to reach out to different organizations, and I can find people in the economic sector or the health sector or in the military sector that were willing and able to help inform me about some of the things that I was ill-informed about, and fill in the gaps, you know, and help me to become a more well-rounded person.
On today's episode of the Lessons Learned for Vets podcast, I am welcoming Dr. Bernard Tony. Bernard is a decorated Army combat veteran who was a former White House medical officer. He retired from the U.S. Army last year in 2022, and the next month went right to work as a practice provider and associate investigator for the National Institutes of Health. He is also the co-founder and vice chair for Stepping Stones for Global Development, an organization that provides health and education resources in resource-scarce communities. And I am so excited to welcome Bernard to the show today. And I met him last year back in season two, and I said, I know we've got to lead off with this episode. So I'm excited to have you here as our launch episode, Bernard. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Lori. It's a pleasure to be here.
Everybody knows that I start this show off with the transition story, right? That's the story that we often tell. And we are going to get to your transition story. But what I find really compelling and fascinating about you is kind of your story of how you went into the Army. And if you're not already following Bernard, who really goes by Tony, because he says that he's been called that his whole life in the military, but if you're not following him yet, you've got to do that, because he's put out some amazing content that will really make you think. But you talk a lot on LinkedIn just about like the importance of your environment to your success. And so talk to me a little bit about kind of how you grew up and what led you to the Army.
Well, I can tell you that I did grow up in sort of a socioeconomically disadvantaged household in Atlanta, Georgia. We were, I would say, on a scale, a lower income class family. And I grew up in an area that was relatively unsafe. We can get into more of that as if you want, how I came into the military. But essentially, I grew up around a lot of violence, a lot of illicit substance abuse by people around me, crime and things of that nature. And I wasn't really on a trajectory of doing much of anything with my life going into the military. So it was by default that I responded to a recruiter's call. And I remember seeing my dad's uniform in the past. I think he served about 3 years active duty and about 4 years in the reserve. So I did have some nexus of the military before deciding to join myself.
And so you know, from that start, kind of went on to be a licensed physician assistant. You know, we said you are Dr. Bernard Tony, right? So, and you provided healthcare to two vice presidents, both Mike Pence and Kamala Harris, and their spouses. And just tell me about your career through the military and through the Army and how you landed there.
Well, I can tell you that my career was very serpiginous in a lot of ways. I started off as a Russian linguist. I didn't do very well in Russian linguistics. So I found myself going back to retrain as a combat medic and a mental health technician. I did that for a few years before returning back to the idea of languages, and I became a French cryptologic linguist. I did that in Army Special Forces for about 3 years. Before deciding to go back to college, to ROTC, and I commissioned as a Medical Service Corps officer. I ran a clinic in Germany. I was a general aide for some time. And then I decided, you know, I like administering medicine from an administrative perspective. Let me try my hand at practicing medicine. And so from that point, I had a very steep crescendo, as far as I'm concerned, with my career, where I really only practiced medicine for about a year before I started doing very unorthodox jobs, working at a 4-star general headquarters. I attended flight surgeon school while in the military to understand aerospace medicine and take care of pilots. And then very shortly after, I was identified as a potential candidate to serve at the White House. And I was actually in Korea when I came out to D.C. to interview. And then after on my flight back, they called me and told me, you've been selected. Pack up your bags. You have about 3 weeks to get to the White House.
Wow. That is, I mean, you know, you make it all sound so casual. Like, I just went from here to here to here. It's just that, you know, I know we make it sound simple, but, you know, you really kind of skimmed over your background. But I remember reading, like you said, one of your best friends literally died in your arms from a drive-by shooting that, you know, you were almost caught up in. And I just really, like, I found that story of kind of where you came from to where you've reached today to be just a fascinating story. And I know we just kind of skimmed right over it as though, you know, just went from this to this after snapping your fingers, but it takes a lot of hard work and fortitude. And like, tell me a little bit about kind of how you got through all of that.
Well, you know, I think that first story is very important because I think that's what gave me the idea of medicine. So when I was 17 years old, I was involved in a drive-by shooting in Atlanta, Georgia. And we were, I had already committed to joining the military. So I was a delayed entry person that signed a contract in my senior year of high school to join the military. So I was already committed, but this was March of 1999. And I'm dating myself here. But I was 17 years old at the time. And, my friend and I were leaving a club. We were probably hanging out with some nefarious characters, if you will, and we were caught up in a drive-by shooting in which I was the driver. My friend was in the passenger seat. As I recall, he took one round to the chest, and that was the fatal shot that killed him. And I remember just trying to get out of the kill zone, you know, and your military listeners will resonate with that there were a lot of shots being fired, and I was essentially just trying to get out of there. Once I got to an area that was safe enough to pull him out of the car, I was, you know, in the process of calling 911, and I'm talking to the dispatcher, and she's asking me questions about where is he shot, you know, and I couldn't ascertain anything about, you know, his level of breathing and where he was hemorrhaging and where the puncture wound was and all these things that were very foreign to me. I couldn't answer any questions. And so it was probably one of the situations in my life where I felt the most helpless, and I never wanted to feel that way again. And so I found myself following this pathway of understanding medicine, specifically trauma medicine. And that's what I did. You know, if you fill in all the blanks, I did a lot of jobs in medicine, but I kind of ended up Focusing on the worst case scenario. What happens if the president is shot?
I'm kind of speechless about that. That's amazing that you were able to take that situation, and it really did transform your life. And we hate to have that be the catalyst, but I know sometimes it does take those really jarring situations to get us moving forward, right?
Absolutely.
As I said in your bio, you just retired within the last year, right? When in 2022 did you retire from the Army?
My retirement day was August 30th. So it's only been, I guess, 5 months.
It's really fresh. And so, I mean, you had really reached like the pinnacle of your career. I mean, some might say that you were in the big show, right? And, you know, and you think about everything you had accomplished, you know, from where you started to where you ended. Was that a really difficult decision for you to decide, like, okay, I think it's time to end my Army career?
No, and I think it was one that was well contemplated and planned out. My wife and I, we certainly missed each other a lot in those last 3.5, almost 4 years. Right before I went to the White House, they sent me to the Command and General Staff College, and so I was very busy there. And I traveled anywhere between 60 to 80% of the month. Maybe not always traveling outside of the country and out in other states, but when I was in D.C., I wasn't sleeping in my own bed, if that makes sense. And so so we knew that it was a great opportunity, but it was also in Colin Powell's vernacular, I knew when to get off the train. And he was a great mentor. And he said, listen, you have to know when to get off the train. And you know, unfortunately, a lot of people, to include very senior officers, all the way up to like the lieutenant general level, oftentimes don't know how and when to get off the train. And so while it may have seemed premature, my wife and I planned it out as a team.
Were you truly mentored personally by Colin Powell?
So Colin Powell, not individually, but within group settings. So I was a member of the ROCS organization. And so he was a ROCS member. And we would have these meetings where collectively as a group, he would mentor all of us. He was way too important of a man to independently mentor me. But I sat through a lot of closed door sessions with him, and it was very beneficial to get his vantage point, you know, all the way up until his untimely death. I mean, I think the last time we sat down with him, or at least virtually, was over Zoom about 6 minutes before he passed away.
Wow, that's not even a part of your story that I knew. So that, I mean, just to be able to be in the same room with him, he was a great man. And I bet that was an amazing experience for you. You're like just knocking him down. You just got all these experiences. I mean, you were recently at Disney World last year. So, I mean, you know, you got all these things. Colin Powell, Disney World, vice president, you know.
Well, I mean, you have to make the best of what you have. And I feel like, you know, given the cards that I was dealt, a lot of people have been dealt similar cards, and you know, you use what you have, do what you can. And so that's what I've done my entire life.
Yeah, your attitude is great. And we're going to talk more about some of the things that you've put out there. But, you know, when you retired in August, you were working within a month in a new role. You told me you really kind of took a different path than some of your colleagues. So let's get back to that military transition. Tell me how your transition process went. It sounds like it was very well planned. Your wife and you made a decision. You knew exactly what your plan was. So tell me more about how that process went for you.
You know, I use every available resource that the military had to offer. I was in a place where I was transitioning, at least where I wanted to focus my efforts. So the natural pathway for me would have been executive medicine. It would have been doing the same things that I was doing for the president or the vice president, but to maybe do it for CEOs of Fortune 500 companies. I've had friends that have done things like that. In my time working for the administrations that I worked for, the current and the previous, I had an opportunity to travel the world and see things through a different lens. And I was able to take note of a lot of inequity around the world when I was evaluating some of these health systems. My transition was wholly focused on not only how do I transition from the military, but how do I transition my career? And so it took about 3 years to do that. I had some great mentors at the Pentagon that were fraternity brothers of mine, Omega Psi Phi Fraternity, and they sat me down and they gave me an Excel spreadsheet that went 3 years from the date of the date that you wanted to retire. And I just plugged in all of the gaps, and it was about an 80% solution. And in that, you know, that final 20%, I started filling in all the other needs relevant to the transition. So I took advantage of every, you know, it might sound like I'm a company man, but I took advantage of all the SFL TAP resources. I took advantage of Candorful, informational interviews. You know, even though I was well adept at public speaking, I still went through the rehearsal of, you know, explaining who I am and what my mission and vision is for myself as a person and what I can add to an organization. So I rehearsed all of those things well in advance.
I feel like anytime I speak to someone who on the surface looks like, oh, it's just a very easy, smooth transition, like they were paddling, like we always compare it to a duck, right? Like paddling out underwater as fast as they possibly could. And it's work, right? Like you have to do the work. Like you were given those resources, but you put the effort in, right?
It was absolutely a lot of work. I mean, just the, you know, I wasn't really akin to using LinkedIn until I started the transition. But by that point, it's kind of too late. You should have already worked that network about 2 years before. So I really learned a lot in my transition process, and I leveraged every person that can add any value, no matter how big or small, to my transition. I'm deeply grateful for that.
When you and I talked last year, you told me that earlier in your career, you were very hesitant to speak in front of people, right? You talked about how you were embarrassed to speak in front of people because of, you know, you name it, right? You mentioned you got your teeth redone, right? Your background, your lack of confidence. Like, I feel like self-sabotage, imposter syndrome, these are real things that almost all of us deal with. And sometimes I feel like the difference between the people that give into that imposter syndrome and the people that don't are just the ones that say, you know what, I'm going to do it scared, right? But tell me a little bit about kind of how you overcame those feelings of like, I don't belong here, I don't fit in, to go on and achieve what you've achieved.
You know, to your point, for your listeners, I joined the military with 12 gold teeth. And so every time I opened my mouth, it was apparent that I was not like everyone else in that formation. And so that gave me a lot of insecurity. I certainly was, as far as the linguist, and I think that's part of the reason why I didn't do very well initially, was I just didn't feel comfortable opening my mouth once I saw the response after doing so. And there was questions like, did you get into a freak car accident? I remember being compared to Jaws from 007. I'd never watched 007 growing up, so I didn't know what that was. And so I had a lot of trepidation, if you will, to even just open my mouth, let alone speak. Along my career, though, I had a sort of a litany. I think that's a poor term, but this series of people who made me do things that were uncomfortable over and over and over again throughout my career. So if it was, you're going to lead this formation, I don't care how confident or incompetent you are, you're going to do it. Yep. If you're going to go to this promotion board, there are so many things that I did not want to do, but I had leaders, and I can't really explain why, that really wanted to invest in me throughout my career. And they put me in these opportunities to succeed and excel. And I can't say that I always did so. I certainly have my list of failures in the military, but I always had good people that were so invested in seeing someone who maybe didn't have the pedigree. That was maybe not as polished, but they gave me an opportunity to sort of refine, you know, those skills, because I think they're skills that can be developed. They're not innate. And so I developed those skills and I continue to refine them to this day. But, I think I'm allotted opportunities to do so. And I think as leaders, if we can find those opportunities to pull people up and give them the resources and the opportunities to fail or succeed, I think we should be doing that at every juncture.
And I think that from my experience, just having conversations with you, like, you say they saw something in you. And I think sometimes when people see that greatness buried beneath humility, if you will, you know, it's the, like, I see that potential, but there's that humility on top of it. And, you know, sometimes people call that imposter syndrome, or they call it lack of confidence. But to some extent, it's just that you know that, you know, you can do it, but you don't feel like you're entitled to do it. And I feel like sometimes that's a really big part of it, isn't it? That humility is important to that.
Absolutely. I think I've always been humble. There hasn't been a situation or a job that I haven't found myself, you know, being required to have a sense of humility, just because there's no way that I can know everything about, you know, every aspect of my job. I don't have all the resources, all the knowledge. So I really rely on the people around me. And so that's one of the things that I recognized very early on, is that I can't do it by myself. And once I was able to give myself that freedom to say that it's not entirely your responsibility for your success, you know, wholly, that you're going to need mentorship, you're going to need guidance, but you're going to have to be open to all of those ideas. That's when I think the floodgates open. And I found myself being able to reach out to different organizations, and I can find people in the economic sector or the health sector or in the military sector that were willing and able to help inform me about some of the things that I was ill-informed about, and fill in the gaps, you know, and help me to become a more well-rounded person.
I do feel like when you approach that with both humility and an open mind, then you do open yourself up to those opportunities and to those mentors and to just getting support. We talk a lot about on the show about the importance of just being willing to reach out your hand and say, can you help me? Or to be able to say, I don't have the answer, let me go find it, right? And I think that's a big part of it. And it sounds like it's been kind of an undercurrent of your success throughout your career, right?
Yeah, because, you know, we feel so enamored by people who are successful, you know, the stars, the generals, and everyone else. And, it, you know, it's when you put yourself or you allow yourself to be in the same room as those leaders, you realize they're just as human as you are. Yeah. I remember the Surgeon General, Nadja West, you know, just being in a room with her and talking to her. And, you know, she was my boss in Germany, and I met her again in Hawaii, and I met her again at the Commander General Staff College. And every opportunity I had to sit down with her or talk to her, I took it, because she was the epitome of servant leadership. She was humble. And she mentioned not feeling like she had confidence in many of her positions, all the way up to like 07 and 08 and even 09 levels. We're talking to the major general level. I mean, she retired as a lieutenant general. But again, it's not about your innate abilities, usually. A lot of times it's about the people around you who are going to help you. And I believe that iron sharpens iron. And so, and I rely on that quite a bit.
That's a great point, is that know that even the people you look up to, even the Colin Powells of the world, right? The Surgeon Generals of the world, they all have their human, they have their doubts, they have their struggles. And I feel like the biggest difference, like you said, is that they just keep going. Despite all of that, right? So if you're out there and you're struggling and you're feeling like you're not going to make it or you're not going to fit in, you just have to keep trying and keep going forward and just, you know, take that one step after another. So you and I were talking about one of your colleagues. You told me a story that somebody that you know that really struggled, like he loved what he was doing so much in the military that he told you he would do it for free, right? He would have continued doing his job even if the military didn't continue to pay him. And so he loved it so much that he didn't prepare. Tell me about the issues that you told me about that he faced.
A great friend, great mentor. He was, without mentioning his name, he was on his second tour at the White House. He had already worked there before. I met him on his second tour. I'll never forget what he said to me in the back of a motorcade he was training me to do my job. And he said, you know, Tony, I can do this for free. And I felt it was pulsatile. It was palpable how much he loved his job. In that, though, he didn't know when to get off the train. Yeah. And so and he didn't know how to. And I've seen that happen, you know, with a lot of people in my military career, where the military tells them that it's time to go. It can be a reduction in force scenario. It can be you're not going to make 06 or 07 scenario. or E8 or E9 scenario. I've seen this multiple times over, but this particular gentleman, he worked into his last day. I think he sold back most of his leave. There were probably other reasons for doing that, but he was at the vice president's house, I think almost up until the very last day. And that was traumatic for him. His transition was horrific. It took me three years to transition. And I was deliberate and intentional about doing so. I can't imagine doing it in 30 days or 3 weeks or 3 days. And so I'm not entirely sure where he is at this point, because he's been sort of unresponsive. But a lot of that had to do with sort of his, you know, the way that he left the military. And this is a guy who was well-polished, immaculate career, impeccable resume, great credentials, but just hadn't mentally prepared for that transition.
And I think that mindset is so important. I just had a conversation with someone the other day that talked about the emotional side of transition, that yes, like finding a job, writing your LinkedIn, getting your resume prepared, all of that's important, but you have to mentally prepare for this process. Because, you know, I always quote Herb Thompson from his book, The Transition Mission, like, God willing, everyone in the military will transition someday, right? There's only really two options. And so, you know, it's coming, you've got to prepare for it. And, you know, we can't stick our heads in the sands and say, well, someday I'll get to it someday, right? Because you're going to, it will catch you and it will hurt if you are not ready for it, won't it? So, yeah. So I think, you know, many people stay in the military because they love it, because it's a part of who they are, and it will never leave you, but you've also got to figure out who you are outside of the military. So one of the things that I really like about the content that you put out on LinkedIn is that you just really make me think, right? You give people things to think about just being kind to others, about lending a helping hand to those in need, you know, about serving others. I know we talked about that you have founded a nonprofit, you're co-founded a nonprofit. Like, tell me about your kind of just your personal views on leadership and serving others.
Kind of a loaded question, because leadership, I think, is something that is really hard to define, but something that's essential. It's almost like love, right? So like, I mean, you can't see love, you can't taste love, you can't touch love, but you know when you have it. And it's essential. And so I think that leadership is a version of love. It's caring enough about other people to help them get to wherever they want to be in life. That doesn't mean that you have to be an expert in that field. I mentor people that are not in my field, and I've been mentored by many people who would never want to touch a patient because it's not their, you know, not their desire. But I think that leadership is love. And I think that we should all be on a constant journey on how to become better leaders. Not just in our professional lives, but also in our family lives. And I focus on that quite a bit now. To your second question about serving others, one of the things that really stuck with me is this disparate idea of where I've been able to sit aboard Air Force One in the most powerful house in the entire world, in the richest country in the world, but also having been in the poorest countries such as Afghanistan, and seeing how wide that gap is. And it was really hard for me to reconcile everything that I have in excess, a big home, a nice car. I can go where I want to go. I can travel if I want to. But realizing that almost a billion people every single day don't have enough money to stay alive. That is it. They actually do not have enough money to stay alive. And what could keep them alive is maybe a couple of trips to Starbucks for us, you know. And so the higher I got in the hierarchy, the more I realized just how far down many people are. And it was very difficult for me to reconcile that. I'll give you a great example. I was in India for a presidential trip. I was in New Delhi, India, and I was doing my work of planning, doing some medical contingency planning, and I walk outside, and there's a woman almost bare naked, breastfeeding her daughter, and she came up to our vehicle and started banging on the window to ask for money, and I reached into my pocket and I gave her $10, and I knew that wasn't going to go very far, It doesn't, you can't put a Band-Aid on a gaping wound that's hemorrhaging. But I asked my driver and I said, why are her kids not in school? She had her other kids around her. He said, well, it costs money here. I said, well, how much does it cost? And he told me the price. And it was something to the effect of like $4 or $5 every 3 months. But she couldn't afford it. And millions of people couldn't afford that. And so it was difficult for me to go from that scene and 10 minutes later in a 5-star hotel in the same hotel that the president's going to be staying in a couple of days. So I always had this contrast, the split screen of where many people live, to include myself and likely you and your family as well. But then this other, large swath of the population of the entire world that lives in abject poverty. And even if not abject poverty, relative poverty. And so those things were really difficult for me to reconcile. And as I started to transition, I said, you know what? I've lived a great life. Now it's time for me to help other people live a better life.
Can you tell me how people can contribute to your organization? We didn't really plan to talk about it, but can you tell me a little bit about your nonprofit and how people can help?
Yeah, so we, it's Stepping Stones for Global Development. If you just Google that, you'll see our nonprofit, but it's also right on my LinkedIn page. And we do accept in-kind donations, whatever helps. We'll be taking our first trip out to Ecuador as an organization here in March to do some global health work focusing on HPV awareness and cancer identification from a woman's health perspective. So we'll be doing that in the latter part of March. And then we have plans to transition to sub-Saharan Africa in the latter part of the year.
Okay. I will put a link to your organization in the show notes so people can find it through the website and they can find you from that and figure out how they can support your efforts for the organization. So
that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that story with us, because I think that we all get a little comfortable in our lives and we take for granted the things that we have. So I appreciate
Absolutely.
That story.
And I do too. Every single day I have to remind myself that this can all be taken from me in a moment's notice. And every single day that I put food in my mouth, I recognize that there's someone who's suffering from malnutrition because they don't have access to food, And so things like that are really jarring for me. And so that's the focus of my life at this point.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. And thank you for the work that you do with the organization. And it sounds like you're working on education people who are food insecure, and also with healthcare, bringing medical care, correct? Those are all the things Absolutely. That your organization supports. So, okay. All right. You can find more information on that through the show notes. And so we'll put a link to that and everything that we have about the show. Thank you. I just want to leave everybody with something that you put on a post. It's something I just read from you recently. So I'm just going to quote you. Okay. It said, "It's never over until you decide. Remember this fact when hardship comes, like death, divorce, disability, or debt. Know that even in the face of inequity, you are the great equalizer."
I think, it's almost kind of strange to hear my own words read back to me. So sorry for being a little bit shy about it. But yes, we all have a story to tell. And I think that how we are the equalizers are being a testimony for other people. I love telling my story about where I came from. I'll be doing a speaking engagement with troubled youth in the DC and Maryland area next week. And I know for a fact when I go into that auditorium, most of those kids, before they know my story, they might think, "You have no idea what I've been through. You have no idea my walk." And I think that's how we are the great equalizers. We've all gone through something. We've all gone through illness, all of those things that you just mentioned, some version of it. If it hasn't been us personally, we've been a victim of it or been exposed to those types of things. And so being able to be resilient and fighting through it is really the gift that we can give other people, because then it normalizes hardship. It lets other people know that it's never over. And so as long as you continue the good fight, then you can be a testimony for someone else, to be that strength for someone else to push through. Listening to other people's testimonies throughout my life have been profoundly impactful. I've learned a lot from people who've who've gone through some very difficult things. And I've learned a lot through people who have been in very bad situations. I learned a lot about serving others in Afghanistan when we were working with special forces and in a village. And I remember, you know, eating goat meat with the family that was the only goat that they have for a month, you know, and I asked myself, can I do that? You know, can I share my last piece of steak or my meal, you know, with someone else when I know I don't know where the rest of my food will come from for another, you know, 20 or 30 days.
Yeah.
I've learned a lot through people's hardship. And I think that's how we can help other people. Maybe it's not through in-kind donations. Maybe it's not through going around and giving speaking engagements, but it's really just being a testimony to someone who looks like you, thinks like you, or have been in situations like you. And I think we can all learn from each other. And I'm a firm believer in iron sharpening iron. And that's how I live my life. I live my life by being able to tell a story that for some seems almost impossible. To go from living in Atlanta, Georgia, and being involved in a drive-by shooting and living the way I live, to taking care of and providing that medical protection for the most powerful people in the entire world is a story that I could have never imagined from my starting point, from that vantage point, and from that perspective. My testimony is to be able to help people to realize that you can still realize your own potential, your own future, your own success, even in the darkest places.
I really appreciate you sharing the stories with us, because what you just said is exactly why I started the show 3 years ago. I can't believe it's almost two and a half years, but because I know that for those that are in the darkness, they feel like they're the only ones in the darkness. They feel like they're the only ones that are struggling. And so for people like your friend that you talked about earlier, and the one that's feeling like he's never going to find another love like his love of the Army and what he was doing, or the person that thinks they're the only one that can't get a call back on their resume, or whatever it is they're struggling with, I want them to know they're not alone. And there are others out there that feel the same way, that have the same struggles. So I really appreciate you showing us that from a completely different perspective and just being that source of inspiration today. So thank you, Bernard. Thank you so much for joining me on the show.
I really appreciate it. And, you know, one last thing I want to leave is not my quote, but it's from Dr. Rick Risby. He said, listen, you might feel like you're a rock bottom, but rock bottom is a solid foundation upon which to build and upon which to grow. And so I take that with me everywhere I go to when I talk to people who feel like this is rock bottom.
What an amazing way to kick off season 3. I could not have said it better. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Lessons Learned for Vets podcast. If you learned just one lesson today that you believe can help you in your military transition, then I've done my job. Please don't keep this podcast a secret. Share it with as many of your active duty service member friends and transitioning veterans who may be struggling with that process as possible. Please subscribe to the podcast, leave us a review, and join our YouTube channel so you don't miss any lessons that we share.